This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
Kirtland, Ohio. To the Latter-day Saints, a place of history, revelation, doctrine, wonder. That's next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
Kirtland was a stronghold for the church for some 7 years. Many significant things in Latter-day Saint history occurred there. But in order to understand the church in Kirtland, we have to go back to New York, October of 1830. Joseph Smith received a revelation commanding that missionaries be sent into the wilderness among the Lamanites. Accordingly, Parley P. Pratt, Oliver Cowdery, Peter Whitmer Jr., and Ziba Peterson set out toward the west.
Max H. Parkin.
I think it's interesting to know that one of the maybe not ignored events in the history of the church has proven to be one of the most strategically important ones, and that is the mission of the four brethren to the Lamanites. The Book of Mormon makes reference, of course, to the Lamanite people and how they're going to be raised up and blessed in the latter days. Prophet Joseph Smith was very much aware of that promise by the Savior in the third book of Nephi. That border of the Lamanites was the western frontier of America. It was the western boundary of Missouri, or just beyond that boundary. Missouri was the westernmost state in America, and Jackson County, Missouri, was the westernmost county in that state. This mission becomes very, very important, as I say, strategically in Mormonism, because they will introduce Jackson County, Missouri, which will be identified as the Zion of the future, and also because they introduced and converted such an abundant group of faithful Latter-day Saints in Kirtland.
Mark L. Staker.
Now, these four missionaries seem to be projecting the Book of Mormon onto themselves. If you remember in the Book of Mormon, you have Ammon, Aaron, Omner, and Himni who go to the Lamanites as missionaries. Well, there's a letter that Oliver Cowdery signs and has his companions commit to. And in that letter, it promises that they'll be freed from dungeons and prisons as they go out. And it seems to be that they're expecting to have very similar experiences to these four missionaries that go to the earlier Lamanites. They go on their mission. This is a whole new territory for these missionaries. They walk, which at that time in America was seen as something most Americans didn't do. But it appears that the missionaries walked because that was part of making them available to share the gospel with others as they traveled. As they traveled through this territory, you had 4 billion passenger pigeons would fly over air. As they traveled during the time of the pigeon migration, and although passenger pigeons are extinct today and it's hard for us to imagine that experience, the sky would have been dark for days as they traveled.
Several individuals whom the missionaries met in the Kirtland area and later baptized became instrumental in building the church's base in that area. One of those was Isaac Morley. But as is so often the case, conversion is complicated and demands sacrifice.
They walk into a house, ask for food, they're hungry. There's a young girl there, 15-year-old girl, Lucy Morley, who's helping the woman do some weaving. And the woman, they tell her a little bit about their message, ask to eat. She says she has food, but she's not going to give them any. Doesn't want to have anything to do with them. Kicks them out of her house.
Ooh.
Lucy Morley hears a little bit of what they have to say. She runs after them and says, "My father will listen to you.
Isaac
Go to him."
Morley.
He's Isaac Morley.
Okay.
He's in Kirtland, about a mile away. and gives them directions. They go to the Morty Farm in Kirtland, Ohio. The people there at the Morty Farm stay up all night talking. Isaac Morty talks to his father, Thomas Morty, all night about it. His father rejects it, is not interested in what these missionaries have to say. Isaac turns into a missionary that night. He's convincing his father that what they have to say is true, even before he's baptized, even before he's committed himself. His father tells him to get out of the house and to never darken his door again.
Ooh.
Isaac leaves. He lives across the street. He never talks to his father again. Isaac Morley owned a large farm, and his farm served as a place where people could come and live. Because it was a communal farm, everybody working together, it was very successful. They were making quite a good living, all living together. But because Isaac Morley owned the property, it was the Morley family, because he was the center of it all. He was the one that gave up his well-being, so to speak, so that people could come here to live.
The fertile religious soil of Ohio, once a part of the Western Reserve of Connecticut, boiled with spiritual fervor. There were groups of people seeking primitive Christianity based on the Book of Acts, and the missionaries encountered these groups. One of these was a man of some note, a minister in eastern Ohio, a man by the name of Sidney Rigdon.
They end up taking a short detour to talk to Sidney Rigdon. Because of his acquaintance with Parley P. Pratt. He seems noncommittal and fairly cool about the whole thing. He ends up interested, but it's a failure. You know, they preach to his congregation, they preach to him, and they end up leaving him without any success. Sidney Rigdon comes to Kirtland to perform a marriage, and he begins traveling with the missionaries. At that time, Sidney Rigdon begins talking as though he believes what the missionaries have to say. There seems to be a transition in his life that takes place during this traveling and while they're preaching about the Book of Mormon. When he realized that the church was true, he and his wife, Phoebe, stayed up all night talking about it. Phoebe says they counted the cost. They knew what this commitment would mean to them. But they believed it was true. And it was an incredible act of courage on their part to join the church, because the congregation and mentor had built them a nice small home to live in. They lost that. They were kicked out of their home. They lost their livelihood. They lost everything. Literally thousands of people came to Kirtland from the surrounding counties, from far and wide, to hear what these missionaries had to say. Had a huge impact. The individuals that joined the church in Kirtland, up to 200 individuals, when there are a little over 300 adults in town, you can imagine that it's a huge impact on Kirtland itself.
In Kirtland, Sidney Rigdon and another partially converted member of his congregation, Edward Partridge, took a trip to New York to get acquainted with Joseph Smith and to inform him of the success that these missionaries had had in Kirtland.
Upon meeting Joseph Smith, Edward Partridge was convinced of the truthfulness of the work and requested baptism. Hearing the report from these two men about the success of the work in Kirtland, Joseph inquired of the Lord and received two very significant revelations, sections 37 and 38 in our present Doctrine and Covenants. They would have a great impact on the members of the church.
The prophet Joseph received a number of revelations, one of which was the revelation for the church to gather. And their first gathering place was to be this new center, which had been identified, Kirtland, Ohio.
Stephen C. Harper.
This is a revelation that tells people to move, literally move geographically, and when to move, and how to move, and so on. So it's worth taking a close look at.
Okay.
If we can read these words here in transition, this soon, we have the end of the prophecies of Enoch, or the writings of Enoch here, and then soon after the words of Enoch were given, the Lord gave the following commandment, and this a revelation to Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon given December 1830, is what most of us know as Doctrine and Covenants, section 37. It's short, just three or four verses, as I recall.
All right.
And it's a commandment for Joseph and Sidney to not work on their revision of the Bible any further, what we call sometimes the Joseph Smith translation. They don't need to do that right now. What they need to do now is move to Ohio. And we're talking now, of course, about a journey that's geographical, but largely cultural. They're to leave the world, not only to leave New York State, but they're to leave the world, Babylon, as some of the revelations call it, worldliness, whereas their world is partisan. The revelations say, be one. This one does. And if you're not one, you're not mine.
Right.
And whereas the world is materialistic, this revelation commands them to stop being materialistic and to forsake their own selfish interests. And so you can see that if the Lord is calling them to the temple to receive an endowment of power, which he promises in the revelation, if you move to Ohio, I will endow you with power from on high. Right? If you move to Ohio, there I will give you my law of consecration. Nobody has to go. From the records that we have, we know that all of them but one went, remarkably, without any coercion at all. They believe these revelations come from God, and they follow them at enormous personal sacrifice.
It was the coldest winter in America. Blizzards cut people off from communicating with each other, and there was no way to really keep control of what was happening in Kirtland as the weather turned poorly. Now, in February, the weather changes. It allows people to come through, and Joseph's one of the first of those.
There were problems in the church when Joseph arrived in Kirtland. It seems that there was already an existing religious tradition in the area that when people were baptized into the church, they brought it with them. And it was causing difficulty and contention in the congregations.
Trying to understand Kirtland, Ohio, we really need to go back almost 30 years before the Latter-day Saints arrive. The roots of Kirtland start with a gentleman named Barton Stone. He's a Presbyterian minister. And in 1800, he and a group of his colleagues hold a large camp meeting. And from that meeting, camp revivals spread throughout the country.
Grant Underwood.
One of the realities that they encounter in this area, when the saints come to Ohio, one of the challenges that they face for a number of months is the religious expression that might be considered today somewhat Pentecostal. This sense of physical engagement with the spirits moving upon us. So we see in a tiny little branch near here, early saints trying to grapple with what is the proper expression of religiosity, of being moved upon by the Spirit. Now, historians know that these folks who are brand new converts in the church have come out of an environment of revivals and camp meetings where that was the conventional way to express religiosity. That was the dramatic display that demonstrated you were truly moved upon by the Lord. And part of the challenge for the early LDS community was to kind of define and refine their particular style of religiosity.
They were baptized in a lot of people that had very little exposure to the revelations, even to the Book of Mormon, to anything other than an understanding that there was a new revelation and that there was a prophet again on the earth. And it brought a lot of people into the church, but they had no direction as to how they should carry out their belief.
All in this time before Joseph actually arrives in the Ohio, the new converts are filled with zeal for their new faith, but they lack understanding. They don't know the doctrine. They don't even know what to call themselves.
They didn't really have a name for themselves yet. The newspapers call them the Work or the Gold Bible Faith. other things that they were calling them, but they didn't really have a name for themselves. They called, the Church of Christ, but others were calling themselves the Church of Christ. They called themselves disciples. As these things were getting out of control, and it was creating a tension within the group, the newspapers are struggling, trying to figure out, what do we call these people? The work, the Gold Bible people, Josiahites. One of the newspapers, Eber D. Howe is the editor of the newspaper. Eber D. Howe likes to play with words. He's the acknowledged inventor of the word bogus.
Okay.
And he comes up with words to try to explain things. And he calls this group of people Mormonites.
Oh, that's where it started then.
And immediately after that, other newspapers who've been calling them different things start saying, well, we understand they're Mormonites. Very early on in this Kirtland experience, that name becomes part of their identity.
How long does it take before it becomes just Mormons, or do we know?
It takes a couple of years. By and large, 1831, they're just Mormonites. By 1835, the believers in Kirtland are known as Mormons instead of Mormonites.
But either way, it sounds like Mormonites was not a very friendly, complimentary term in the context it was used at the time.
It's not. But I think that it was acceptable to them because it captured the book that shaped their experience.
I see.
Most people at that time identified with their leader, the Campbellites, because Alexander Campbell led them. They were calling this group, one newspaper said Josiahites, which you'd think would be appropriate because Joseph Smith is their leader. But Joseph Smith takes a back row to the Book of Mormon.
I see, yeah.
By that name. Being Mormonites, then, it is the Book of Mormon that serves as the core of their experience and not Joseph Smith. Of course, through Revelation, they become the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Kirtland and identify with that formally. Over time.
There were many things of importance that occurred in the Kirtland area, but notable among these, from the Doctrine and Covenants as it presently stands, there were more revelations received in Kirtland and the surrounding area than anywhere else in early church history, beginning on the Isaac Morley farm.
Carl R. Anderson.
Well, the first section that came in Kirtland is section 41. And in section 41, the Lord commanded the church to build a home for Joseph in which he could live and translate. And, of course, Father Morley, who's here, is representative of the nickname they gave him, which was Father. He was a wonderful, kind, benevolent soul who welcomed everybody in. And when the church was told in section 41 to build a home, this is where they came and did it. And Father Morley moved over, and Joseph and Emma moved in with them. And then they constructed a small home, according to Isaac Morley's daughter. It was a small frame home with only a couple of rooms. According to Parley P. Pratt, one of those rooms was a revelation room / translating room. And Parley tells of coming here into that revelation room where Joseph received section 50 in their presence. And as you go back down the hill, there's a sign similar to this one at the bottom that has Parley Pratt's description of how Joseph received revelation and the background to section 50. Well, they build the home for Joseph and Emma. This is where the twins were born and died. This is where the Murdoch twins were adopted. This was the first place that we lived the law of consecration. It's where the Lord corrected in section 42, made corrections as to what was happening there.
Now, Joseph gets to Ohio and receives a flood of revelation. Now, the Lord is good to his word. He had said to the saints, if you move to Ohio, I will give you my law. Well, Joseph isn't there for more than 3 weeks before he's got the law. Doctrine comes section 42, as we know it today, the law of consecration or the law of the church.
If you look carefully at this document, and ideas that they had, you see a lot of overlap. Issues like marriage are addressed in here. How should marriage be abolished? How should we establish marriage relationships? And this document addresses some of those issues. It addresses property issues as well. It allows for holding all things in common, but begins to move in a different direction. This revelation modifies in some ways the communal organization that they were practicing in Kirtland. This also addresses gifts of the Spirit.
Right.
Because that's exactly what they were focusing on. They were trying to implement the gifts of the Spirit in their lives. And it acknowledges that they are correct gifts. Speaking in tongues is a gift of the Spirit. But it serves as a foundation that allows them to move away over the next 2 months from a lot of the things that they were doing during December and January. Now this document here, section 42 of the Doctrine and Covenants, also introduces the idea that missionaries will go two by two.
Right.
Before that time, you have missionaries going out to preach. We have four missionaries going together, taking the Sons of Messiah model, all going together.
While Joseph continued to set the church in order in Kirtland, the faithful and the curious from all around heard of him. His reputation was spreading, and they came to meet him. Among those was John and Elsie Johnson, their minister, Ezra Booth, and a friend named Simons Ryder.
Simons Ryder was among a group of individuals who had gone up to Kirtland, Ohio, with Elsa Johnson. Elsa and her husband, John Johnson, stayed up all night reading the Book of Mormon with their minister, Ezra Booth. Their son, Lyman Johnson, had gotten a copy of the Book of Mormon, brought it home. They stayed up. They gained a testimony that Joseph Smith was a prophet, or at least they had a strong belief that he was, and that he could heal the sick. Elsa Johnson has a disability of some kind with her right arm. Some say it's an attack of rheumatism. Others imply something else. They take their doctor along with them. They take Ezra Booth. Simon's Ryder goes. And while they're there visiting Joseph Smith, accounts differ a little bit in the details, but George A. Smith, I think, has the best handle on what happens there. He says that they lay hands on top of her head and bless Elsa that she'll be healed, and she's healed. Her arm then works as good as it ever did, and the individuals there view that as a miracle. And of course it was. Mm-hmm. They go back home and are baptized. Simon seems to hold back a little bit from joining the church. It's not clear why, after seeing something like that, why he would wait. But he looks for additional confirmation, and he finds that in some prophecies that a young girl makes about earthquakes in China and other things that seem to be a little more tangential to the experience that they are having there. But he seems to have doubts from the beginning. Then he goes to the June conference in Kirtland, and at that conference, he's called to serve a mission. He refuses to go, or decides not to go, returns home to his family.
Simon's Ryder leaves, and we all know, why did he leave? There you go. Misspelled his name. I didn't hire him if you'd have had time. One of the fun things is to go to his headstone. And the stonecutter acknowledged on his headstone that he helped found the Disciples Church or was a disciple. The only problem, the stonecutter in cutting it misspelled the word disciple twice. He made Simons a great disciple. But so that's one of the great ironies of church history.
Robert J. Woodford.
We have now found several documents in Simon's writer's handwriting, including section 52 of the Doctrine and Covenants, which has his name in it, and he does not spell it correctly. Whenever he signs his name, he signs it correctly, S-Y-M-O-N-D-S-R-Y-D-E-R. But whenever he spells his name, it's R-I-D-E-R. And so even he had a problem with it.
Meanwhile, Ezra Booth, who was John and Elsa Johnson's minister, a Methodist minister, he had left his congregation and was going around preaching locally and had had a lot of influence, and a lot of people respected him, knew Greek, knew other languages, had a lot of education, had gone to Yale, a sophisticated individual. He is called to go on a mission too and commanded to walk to Missouri. It's a little too menial for him, particularly when Joseph Smith takes a carriage mm-hmm. and goes there.
Right.
And so he sees Joseph as a little elevated above him. When he comes back from Missouri, he's very negative about the church. He has a very close friend of his, Ira Eddy. He writes some letters to, and Ira Eddy publishes those, has them published in the local newspaper. Those letters have a huge impact on the church. Ezra Booth writes these letters to his friend Ira Eddy. Ira takes them to the local newspaper. The first letter is published on page 3. He begins to outline some of the complaints that he has with Joseph Smith and the church. It seems to strike a real chord with a lot of people in the area. The newspaper is circulated far and wide. Other newspapers pick up the letters and reprint them in their newspapers.
Oh, my word.
They get a lot of attention.
So Ezra Booth becomes really...
Ezra Booth becomes a local celebrity
of
sorts. He's not necessarily interested in being a careful historian. He's interested in just expressing his own anger and frustration with what he's been involved with. And it really takes off. Now, Joseph Smith receives a revelation that he's to counter Ezra Booth. And so he and Sidney Rigdon go out and begin preaching, and they challenge Ezra Booth to a debate. And he backs down, you know, that he's... Here's a man educated at Yale and an uneducated well digger from New York wants to debate him, and he backs down because he knows that he doesn't really have any dirt, so to speak.
While so many are gathering to Kirtland and rejoicing in their newfound faith, Ezra Booth, Simon's writer, and others leave the faith. But they can't leave it alone. And then a new revelation is received, more powerful and profound than any heretofore. And while it opens up the heavens to the faithful, it brings down the wrath of the apostates on Joseph. Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, the vision and the tar and feathers that changed Joseph forever. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.